Chapter 8. After Signorina had finished that exquisite melody, the last rose of summer, one of these floral pile drivers came cleaving down through the atmosphere of applause, and if he hadn't deployed suddenly to the right, it would have driven her into the floor like a shingle nail. Of course that bouquet was well meant, but how would you like to have been the target? A sincere compliment is always grateful to a lady, so long as you don't try to knock her down with it. Young mother, and so you think a baby is a thing of beauty and a joy forever? Well, the idea is pleasing, but not original. Every cow thinks the same of its own calf. Perhaps the cow may not think it so elegantly, but still she thinks it nevertheless. I honor the cow for it. We all honor this touching maternal instinct wherever we find it, be it in the home of luxury, or in the humble cove shed. But really, madam, when I come to examine the matter in all its bearings, I find that the correctness of your assertion does not assert itself in all cases. A soiled baby, with a neglected nose, cannot be conscientiously regarded as a thing of beauty. And inasmuch as babyhood spans but 3 short years, no baby is competent to be a joy orator. It pains me thus to demolish 2/3 of your pretty sentiment in a single sentence, but the position I hold in this chair requires that I shall not permit you to deceive and mislead the public with your plausible figures of speech. I know a female baby, aged 18 months, in this city, which cannot hold out as a oi 24 hours on a stretch, let alone over. And it possesses some of the most remarkable eccentricities of character and appetite that have ever fallen under my notice. I will set down here a statement of this infant's operations, conceived, planned, and earned out by itself, and without suggestion or assistance from its mother or anyone else, during a single day, and what I shall say can be substantiated by the sworn testimony of witnesses. It commenced by eating 12 large blue mass pills, box and all. Then it fell down a flight of stairs, and arose with a blue and purple knot on its forehead, after which it proceeded in quest of further refreshment and amusement. It found a glass trinket ornamented with brass work smashed up, and ate the glass, and then swallowed the brass. Then it drank about 20 drops of laudanum, and more than a dozen tablespoonfuls of strong spirits of camphor. The reason why it took no more laudanum was because there was no more to take. After this it lay down on its back, and shoved 5 or 6 inches of a silver-headed whalebone cane down its throat. Got it fast there, and it was all its mother could do to pull the cane out again, without pulling out some of the child with it. Then, being hungry for a glass again, it broke up several wine glasses, and fell to eating and swallowing the fragments, not minding a cut or two. Then it ate a quantity of butter, pepper, salt, and California matches, actually taking a spoonful of butter, a spoonful of salt, a spoonful of pepper, and 3 or 4 lucifer matches at each mouthful. I will remark here that this thing of beauty likes painted German lucifers, and eats all she can get of them, but she prefers California matches, which I regard as a compliment to our home manufacturers of more than ordinary value, coming, as it does, from one who is too young to flatter. Then she washed her head with soap and water, and afterward ate what soap was left, and drank as much of the suds as he had room for, after which she sallied forth, and took the cow familiarly by the tail, and got kicked heels overhead. At odd times during the day, when this joy forever happened to have nothing particular on hand, she put in the time, by climbing up on places, and falling down off them, uniformly damaging herself in the operation. As young as she is, she speaks many words tolerably distinctly, and being plain-spoken in other respects, blunt and to the point, she opens conversation with all strangers, male or female, with the same formula, "How do, Jim?" Not being familiar with the ways of children, it is possible that I have been magnifying into matter of surprise things which may not strike anyone who is familiar with infancy as being at all astonishing. However, I cannot believe that such is the case, and so I repeat that my report of this baby's performances is strictly true, and if anyone doubts it, I can produce the child. I will further engage that she will devour anything that is given her, reserving to myself only the right to exclude anvils, and fall down from any place to which she may be elevated, merely stipulating that her preference for alighting on her head shall be respected, and, therefore, that the elevation chosen shall be high enough to enable her to accomplish this to her satisfaction. But I find I have wandered from my subject. So, without further argument, I will reiterate my conviction that not all babies are things of beauty and joys forever. Rhythmeticus. Virginia, Nevada. I'm an enthusiastic student of mathematics, and it is so vexatious to me to find my progress constantly impeded by these mysterious arithmetical technicalities. Now do tell me what the difference is between geometry and conchology. Here you come again with your arithmetical conundrums, when I am suffering death with a cold in the head. If you could have seen the expression of scorn that darkened my countenance a moment ago, and was instantly split from the center in every direction like a fractured looking glass by my last sneeze, you never would have written that disgraceful question. Conchology is a science which has nothing to do with mathematics. It relates only to shells. At the same time, however, a man who opens oysters for a hotel, or shells a fortified town, or sucks eggs, is not, strictly speaking, a conchologist. A fine stroke of sarcasm that, but it will be lost on such an unintellectual clam as you. Now compare conchology and geometry together, and you will see what the difference is, and your question will be answered. But don't torture me with any more arithmetical horrors until you know I am rid of my cold. I feel the bitterest animosity toward you at this moment bothering me in this way, when I can do nothing but sneeze and rage and snort pocket-handkerchiefs to atoms. If I had you in range of my nose now I would blow your brains out. To raise poultry, being a letter written to a poultry society that had conferred a complimentary membership upon the author. Written about 1870. Seriously, from early youth I have taken an especial interest in the subject of poultry raising, and so this membership touches a ready sympathy in my breast. Even as a schoolboy, poultry raising was a study with me, and I may say without egotism that as early as the age of 17 I was acquainted with all the best and speediest methods of raising chickens, from raising them off a roost by burning lucifer matches under their noses, down to lifting them off a fence on a frosty night by insinuating the end of a warm board under their heels. By the time I was 20 years old, I really suppose I had raised more poultry than any one individual in all the section round about there. The very chickens came to know my talent by and by. The youth of both sexes ceased to paw the earth for worms, and old roosters, that came to crow, remained to prey, when I passed by. I have had so much experience in the raising of fowls that I cannot but think that a few hints from me might be useful to the society. The two methods I have already touched upon are very simple and are only used in the raising of the commonest class of fowls. One is for summer, the other for winter. In the one case you start out with a friend along about 11 o'clock on a summer's night, not later, because in some states, especially in California and Oregon, chickens always rouse up just at midnight and crow from 10 to 30 minutes, according to the ease or difficulty they experience in getting the public waked up, and your friend carries with him a sack. Arrived at the hen roost, your neighbor's, not your own, you light a match, and hold it under first one, and then another pullet's nose until they are willing to go into that bag without making any trouble about it. You then return home, either taking the bag with you, or leaving it behind, according as circumstances shall dictate. N. B. I have seen the time when it was eligible and appropriate to leave the sack behind and walk off with considerable velocity without ever leaving any word where to send it. In the case of the other method mentioned for raising poultry, your friend takes along a covered vessel with a charcoal fire in it, and you carry a long slender plank. This is a frosty night, understand? Arrived at the tree, or fence, or other hen roost your own, if you are an idiot, you warm the end of your plank in your friend's fire vessel, and then raise it aloft, and ease it up gently against a slumbering chicken's foot. If the subject of your attentions is a true bird, he will infallibly return thanks with a sleepy cluck or two, and step out and take up quarters on the plank, thus becoming so conspicuously accessory before the fact to his own murder, as to make it a grave question in our minds as it once was in the mind of Blackstone, whether he is not really and deliberately committing suicide in the second degree.
But you enter into a contemplation of these legal refinements subsequently, not then.
When you wish to raise a fine, large, donkey-voiced Shanghai rooster, you do it with a lasso, just as you would a bull. It is because he must choke, and choke effectually too. It is the only good, certain way, for whenever he mentions a matter which he is cordially interested in, the chances are 99 in 100, that he secures somebody else's immediate attention to it too, whether it day or night. The Black Spanish is an exceedingly fine bird and a costly one. $30-$5 is the usual figure and 50 a not uncommon price for a specimen. Even its eggs are worth from $1 to $1.50 a piece, and yet are so unwholesome that the city physician seldom or never orders them for the workhouse. Still, I have once or twice procured as high as a dozen at a time for nothing, in the dark of the moon. The best way to raise the Black Spanish fowl is to go late in the evening and raise coop and all. The reason I recommend this method is that, the birds being so valuable, the owners do not permit them to roost around promiscuously. They put them in a coop as strong as a fireproof safe, and keep it in the kitchen at night. The method I speak of is not always a bright and satisfying success, and yet there are so many little articles of vertu about a kitchen, that if you fail on the coop you can generally bring away something else. I brought away a nice steel trap one night, worth 90 cents. But what is the use in my pouring out my whole intellect on this subject? I have shown the Western New York Poultry Society that they have taken to their bosom a party who is not a spring chicken by any means, but a man who knows all about poultry, and is just as high up in the most efficient methods of raising it as the president of the institution himself. I thank these gentlemen for the honorary membership they have conferred upon me, and shall stand at all times ready and willing to testify my good feeling, and my official zeal by deeds as well as by this hastily penned advice and information. Whenever they are ready to go to raising poultry, let them call for me any evening after 11 o'clock. Experience of the McWilliamses with membranous croup,
as related to the author of this book by Mr. McWilliams, a pleasant New York gentleman whom the said author met by chance on a journey.
Well, to go back to where I was before, I digressed to explain to you how that frightful and incurable disease, membranous croup,
diphtheria D. W.W.,
was ravaging the town and driving all mothers mad with terror. I called Mrs. McWilliams' attention to little Penelope, and said, "Darling, I wouldn't let that child be chewing that pine stick, if I were you." "Precious, where is the harm in it?" said she, but at the same time preparing to take away the stick, for women cannot receive even the most palpably judicious suggestion without arguing it, that is married women. I replied, "Love, it is notorious that pine is the least nutritious wood that a child can eat." My wife's hand paused in the act of taking the stick and returned itself to her lap. She bridled perceptibly and said, "Hubby, you know better than that. You know you do. Doctors all say that the turpentine in pine wood is good for weak back and the kidneys." Ah, I was under a misapprehension. I did not know that the child's kidneys and spine were affected, and that the family physician had recommended, who said the child's spine and kidneys were affected? My love, you intimated it.
the idea. I never intimated anything of the kind. Why, my dear, it hasn't been 2 minutes since you said, bother what I said. I don't care what I did say. There isn't any harm in a child chewing a bit of pine stick, if she wants to, and you know it perfectly well. And she shall chew it too. So there, now. Say no more, my dear. I now see the force of your reasoning, and I will go, and order 2 or 3 cords of the best pine wood today. No child of mine shall want while I, please go along to your office, and let me have some peace. A body can never make the simplest remark, but you must take it up, and go to arguing and arguing and arguing till you don't know what you are talking about, and you never do. Very well, it shall be as you say. But there is a want of logic in your last remark which, however, she was gone with a flourish, before I could finish, and had taken the child with her. That night at dinner she confronted me with a face as white as a sheet. Oh, Mortimer, there's another. Little Gear Guy Gordon is taken. Membranous croup? Membranous croup. Is there any hope for him? None in the wide world. Oh, what is to become of us? By and by a nurse brought in our Penelope, to say good night and offer the customary prayer at the mother's knee. In the midst of how I lay me down to sleep, she gave a slight cough. My wife fell back like one stricken with death. But the next moment she was up, and brimming with the activities which terror inspires. She commanded that the child's crib be removed from the nursery to our bedroom, and she went along to see the order executed. She took me with her, of course. We got matters arranged with speed. A cot bed was put up in my wife's dressing room for the nurse. But now Mrs. McWilliams said we were too far away from the other baby, and what if he were to have the symptoms in the night and she blanched again, poor thing. We then restored the crib and the nurse to the nursery and put up a bed for ourselves in a room adjoining. Presently, however, Mrs. McWilliams said suppose the baby should catch it from Penelope? This thought struck a new panic to her heart, and the tribe of us could not get the crib out of the nursery again fast enough to satisfy my wife, though she assisted, in her own person and well-nigh pulled the crib to pieces, in her frantic hurry. We moved downstairs, but there was no place there to stow the nurse, and Mrs. McWilliams said the nurse's experience would be an inestimable help. So we returned, bag and baggage, to our own bedroom once more, and felt a great gladness, like storm-buffeted birds, that have found their nest again. Mrs. McWilliams sped to the nursery, to see how things were going on there. She was back in a moment with a new dread. She said, "What can make baby sleep so?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.